This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in East Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Ed Pulford, one of the hosts of the channel, coming to you today from Tokyo in Japan. On the podcast today, we have Ji-Eun Baek, a doctoral student in public policy at Oxford University's Blavatnik School of Government, who will be talking about her book, North Korea's Hidden Revolution, How the Information Underground is Transforming a Closed Society, which was published in 2016 by Yale University Press. We're now in what may be one of the most important periods for North Korean affairs in recent memory, a fact which has raised excitement at the prospects of significant change in the country. But as my guest today, Ji-Eun Baek, will tell you, meaningful change has been afoot in North Korea for much longer than just the past few months. Much of this has come in the form of transformations in the kind of information that North Koreans have access to, whether foreign, often South Korean, television or music, news reports offering citizens alternatives to Pyongyang's official media narratives, or even entertainment produced by North Koreans who have escaped the country and then beamed back shows into their former homeland, DPRK citizens today live in a much more informationally diverse society than the all-too-common hermit kingdom label would imply. In addition to this, many other goods and resources are entering the country from outside, with everything from mobile phones to medicine and hard cash being sent via an elaborate network of smugglers, traders, and intermediaries. As well as being for personal use, such items are also increasingly bought and sold at this once more socialist country's ubiquitous public markets. All of this is covered in fascinating detail in Ji-Eun Baek's book, which, engaging and rich in personal reflections throughout, also puts these striking changes into their wider social and political context. Baek does not by any means shy away from the cruelty and fear which continue to be part of daily life in North Korean society, but the story she so deftly tells offers a window into a far wider range of human experience than we're used to hearing about this country, which, we can hope at this new moment of possibility, may be set to change still further. But to discuss all of this, and perhaps even the contemporary moment itself, I'll say Ji-Eun Baek, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, well, thanks very much for appearing, and I'm looking forward a lot to talking about this excellent book. But perhaps before we get into it, I could begin by asking you about yourself and how you became interested in the subject. I mean, I think it's particularly interesting, and you could give us a feel for why it is that, or how it was that a book came out, and you're currently a doctoral candidate, which is kind of the other way around to a lot of the guests that we have on the show.
Right. So this was all quite unplanned. Not in the sense that I mean, I've been interested in North Korea for a very long time. My interest was sparked in the first couple months of college, which was many years ago. And after college, I was working at Google, and that's when I got to think about how to integrate my seemingly disparate interests in human rights and world affairs and technology, and was able to think about how to integrate those into a meaningful way. And so I continued to get involved in projects in and out of the company, and you know, just read a lot and talk to people in this field and a lot of people who've escaped from North Korea, and just sort of developed a richer understanding of North Korea and just general affairs on the peninsula. Then I went back to school to do a master's in public policy, where I was able to spend a significant amount of time with the late Ambassador Stephen Bosworth and my advisor, Professor Graham Allison, and was able to hone in on some of the specific strands of interests that I had centered on North Korea. So I wrote a couple pieces here and there, and an agent was interested, a literary agent reached out to me and pitched this idea of writing a book. And at that point, I was quite apprehensive because exactly what you said, I didn't have a PhD back then. And honestly didn't have serious plans to ever pursue a doctorate. But one thing led to another, and I ended up writing this book on a subject that I am very passionate about, and I know many others are as well. And so the process of writing the book got me interested in continuing research on subjects that I'm very passionate about. So I did what is a pretty commonly reversed sequence of what most people do, which is writing a book first and then doing a doctorate.
And in terms of your involvement, you kind of line things up a little in the first pages of the book in terms of your personal involvement with North Korea and your first visit there and some of your activities, as I understand, as an undergrad. What kind of initial steps did you have in being involved in the country at that point?
Oh, as an undergrad. So I didn't go to North Korea until way later, so this was maybe, let's see, about 4 years after graduating. But for undergrad, I mean, I was involved with a lot of awareness raising events in various human rights aspects of the country, and I think that's how a lot of college students in and out of the United States initially get interested in the country, which is through this very a very specific human rights lens, which is critical for everyone to, I think, get a handle on when studying North Korea. But since then, my interests have broadened out. So it hasn't shifted away from human rights by any means, but it has certainly broadened out to try to understand various dimensions of the country and their bilateral relationship with the United States as well.
I see. And in terms of the actual material that went into the book, it's based on a lot of first-hand interviews with people who've left the country. At what point, where did that fit in terms of gathering that information and practically putting it together?
Right. So in terms of my original interviews, there's about a dozen or so people that I highlight, the dozen or so people stories that I highlight and integrate throughout the book. But just to be clear, this book is, for those who may have not read it, it is certainly not an anthology of stories. This is something that I would like to do some other time. But what I was trying to do with the book was to have a narrative arc following the history of the role that foreign information has played in the country for the past 30 or so years. And I wanted to integrate people's very fascinating and at times heartbreaking stories to flesh out that outline and bring the much needed human element to this overarching narrative arc. In terms of getting the original interview material, I went to Korea and I conducted all sorts of interviews with North Korean defectors as well as key informants. And by that, I mean people who have studied this for a long time and have been involved in this work. So they may be experts in this field, the people who are doing, who are running radio programs into North Korea, or people at Hanawon, or people at the Ministry of Unification, or other human rights activists and missionaries and so forth. So I got a lot of different types of interviews, but I really tried to focus on really understanding people from North Korea and their experience with information when they were in the country. And so I conducted a lot of interviews for this book with their informed consent after I signed the contract with the press. I don't know if this is getting too nitty gritty, but a lot of the conversations I had prior to the book definitely informed my writing. But of course, just to be very technical, you know, without anyone's informed consent, I didn't include any quoted material.
Absolutely. Well, no, I think this is definitely suitable material for us to understand about putting a thing like this together, because actually a lot of the richness of this book is in the personal dimension, both from your own angle, and you mentioned at the beginning that it was two of your grandparents were from the northern half of the peninsula, if that's correct, and then the personal aspect, of course, in how you convey the story of the changing picture of North Korean society and so on that fills the book is also where the tremendous, I guess, strength of what makes the book so compelling. But I think we'll go into it with that. As I say, in the early pages, you set the sort of reasons for doing what you're doing up, and also you have kind of a list of the various protagonists, just to give us a bit of a profile of some of the often anonymized but nevertheless real people who provided you with a lot of the information that's in there. The people you talk to obviously are often called defectors, and in English, and I guess as we understand the terms in which the book is presented, perhaps you could say a bit about the choice of vocabulary in even discussing this kind of issue. What are the choices you have to make around using the term defector, and what other terms are there out there?
Right. And this is something I'm particularly interested in, because, you know, we all hate being labeled or categorized into something, especially if we don't agree with that category or that label. And I think for simplicity's sake, or for argument's sake, or just for consistency's sake, a lot of authors, including myself, make an informed decision to stick with a word and then kind of continue to use that term unless otherwise noted. I've asked a lot of my interviewees and friends who are from the North what terms they feel least uncomfortable with or most comfortable with, and they differ in English and in Korean. So some of the listeners on this podcast may be familiar or speak Korean, but there are all sorts of terms to describe North Korean defectors. So there, it could be, you know, taebukja or saetomin, or, you know, all these other kind of permutations of that, which basically means like, you know, new citizen in the South, or someone who's escaped North Korea, or someone who's a dissident from North Korea. In English, I think generally the term that people use in kind of culture and broader cultural context and media and so forth is defector. That maybe escapees, some people use that term. Other use dissidents. Other use just former North Koreans, or North Koreans who've settled in, you know, U.S., South Korea, or, you know, insert other country of resettlement. Some have preferred the word friends from North Korea, or others just say to me, call me Steven, or call me John Kim. That's it. That is who I am, and that's what I identify with. And I really understand that. I really want to, you know, understand that sentiment. For the sake of writing a book that is easy to understand, I ended up selecting the word defector in English just purely for consistency's sake.
It makes sense.
It's not a perfect choice.
Choices like these have to be
exactly
made.
And I add a bit of a little bit of throat clearing around the subject in the earlier pages. I think it is something that's essential to try to understand the complexity of the term.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think the kind of range of terminology that you laid out there makes it clear why the kind of decision is such a difficult one, because so many of these terms are so politically charged and really set you off on the wrong foot if you're trying to provide the kind of human portrait that you do provide in this book. You don't want to prejudge by having a label that makes certain people seem a certain way, because and this is really my next question, there are a whole diversity of reasons why people have left. Certainly, many of them are not sort of, Solzhenitsyn-esque critics of the regime kind of people. So could you give a sense of the broad picture of why people leave, and who also is it, the people that you spoke to are kind of where they came from,
right,
their background?
And I appreciate this question because and it links to the previous question. When some North Korea watchers sweepingly refer to North Koreans who've escaped their country as dissidents, I think that's a term that is inaccurate. There's no term that's going to be, categorically relevant to everybody, but I think dissident is certainly not one of them, because like you just said, there's many reasons why people leave, and some of them do leave for political reasons, and many of them don't. Many North Korean people do not escape for political reasons. And so I think dissident is certainly not the proper term to refer to everybody. In terms of some of the reasons, I mean, you ask 10 people why they left and you'll get 12 reasons. But I think and the reasons, the most common reason tends to change over time, depending on what era of North Korean modern history we're looking at. But just to give a sense to some of the listeners, it could be purely for economic reasons, just to go to a place where they have more food and resources for one and one's family to survive. Some individuals, especially in the 90s and early 2000s, left North Korea with fully intending to find resources and come back into the country to support their families who were in much dire situations. I think there's a lot of language around what I just described, this phenomenon of returning back as like redefection or double defection or something like this. The idea wasn't to escape. The idea was to leave in order to come back to support. Many individuals, of course, intend to leave the country fully expecting to resettle in a new country, whether that be South Korea, US, UK, or wherever else. I think it just tends to be so that people from the elite echelon, political, intellectual elite of the country, tend to leave for more political reasons, because they're generally not the ones who are extremely resource poor. Some of those individuals may become disillusioned with their government's the governance system, or some individuals across the class system may find themselves in a very precarious situation for whatever political alleged crime they've committed, and they have no choice but to escape. Otherwise, they have to face some penalty for some alleged crime. And so in those instances, we see some people making an overnight decision to defect, because purely out of self, out of survival purposes. And then there are other reasons where other groups of people who want to defect to rejoin family members who defected earlier on. And those are some of the very, very personalized reasons why some people decide to take the life risking a decision to defect.
Right. And I mean, I guess I should obviously clarify that asking the question, why would people leave, isn't to question the justification of their choices. There are clearly many things about the country that you lay out in pretty stark terms in the book that make it clear why, the number of reasons there are to leave are also as numerous as people's own personal motivations. But also just in terms of the numbers, again, for context, how many people overall are we talking about in terms of people who've left over time? Are there difficulties in establishing definite figures?
Yes. So I don't know how many people have escaped the country, but we do have figures, publicly released figures, of numbers of North Koreans who resettled in certain countries. So in South Korea, there's a bit over 30,000. So I think it's about 32,000 or so at this point. individuals who settled and received South Korean citizenship. There are a few over 220 individuals who've resettled in the United States. There's a rough estimate around 1,000 individuals in the United Kingdom. And then several hundreds of individuals in Germany and Austria and Australia, Canada, and some other places. Now, there's a large number, impossible to verify number of individuals in China who've escaped. And because the Chinese government continues to not recognize North Korean defectors as refugees, but rather illegal economic migrants, North Koreans who are hiding in China to this day are not safe to come out. And if they are caught, come out from hiding, if they are caught, they will be forcibly repatriated to North Korea, where they face severe punishment. So we don't know the number of people who are hiding in China. There are all sorts of estimates and some range from 50,000 hiding in China. Some estimates range up to 500,000. I personally don't know, but I think the big takeaway from that point is those individuals are really not safe. And the children born in China are not safe. They are truly stateless, the children of North Korean defectors in China. So the plight does not end just because someone has escaped from North Korea.
No, absolutely not. And actually, from what you say, if the figures, although very hard to verify, span that kind of a range, then that makes that group the largest single cohort of people who've left the country, considerably more than those who have made it to South Korea. So the fact that all of those people are living in such difficult circumstances obviously gives a sense of the severity of the situation. But we'll move on then perhaps into, the richer picture of the lives that they left and what we can understand about specifically this information revolution that you're talking about. So you discuss in the first chapter a kind of history of how North Korea came about and what kind of a place it is. But I really like this discussion because actually it gives a particular angle on what, I guess, to people familiar with modern East Asian history is a somewhat known story, but you look at the history of North Korea through the kind of lens of information and how especially how the government has sought to maintain a certain kind of informational sphere. So could you say something about how the North Korean government would like, if you like, I mean, not to invite you to really put yourself in the shoes of those people, but what can we tell about the kind of informational landscape that Pyongyang tries to ensure is the case or has tried to ensure over time in
right.
North Korea?
So it is. So I think ideally, if they had it their way, and again, I don't want to put myself in their shoes, but just from what we could observe as outsiders, there has been every attempt conceivably imaginable to try to control the information production, circulation, and consumption in the country. So without getting into any of the foreign materials getting in, before we even talk about that, all the newspapers, the magazines, the television shows, the movies, the radio programs, all of this material, every word, every period, every image placed, what pages they're placed on, everything is controlled centrally. And undergoes multiple levels of screening before they are then published for the North Korean citizens to consume. Much of that material is actually viewable for foreigners. You and I and the listeners can start, and right now we can go online and pull up their news channel and their television station, maybe not television station that easily, but news channel. It's their news is translated in multiple languages, and of course not everything that is published domestically is published for a foreign audience, but much of this material is actually accessible for foreigners right at our desks wherever we're sitting around in the world. So everything that's produced is centrally controlled, and everything that is circulated for citizens' consumption is also controlled as well. So, we hear all these crazy stories of radios being placed in every room and every home and office. And that is largely true. It's really impossible to verify that in like very, very underdeveloped rural areas, which is many parts of North Korea. But there are radios not only inside homes and offices and schools, but also outside. So as people are walking, if there's an announcement, it just kind of comes on. And televisions and radios that people buy that are made in North Korea or somehow been sold through North Korean market, like stores, are controlled so that people cannot tamper with and access foreign stations. Now, a lot of this is changing on the fringes, and we can talk more about that in our next bit. But that's that. And now with more devices that are being manufactured in North Korea, like cell phones, Android using cell phones, tablets, and laptops, there are now much more rigorous and comprehensive ways for the government to control information consumption on a digital level. So if anything, the government is becoming much more savvy to control the information flows among its citizens through digital means.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
Right, right. I mean, I guess this is the constant sort of dialectic that's there, isn't it? The kind of technology revolution that has happened globally has been seen in some quarters as, or it may initially have been seen in some quarters as a way of people finding each other and generating solidarity and fighting causes and a kind of potential for ordinary people to advance their own causes. But actually what we've seen, and I guess this is a global phenomenon, but notably in North Korea's giant neighbor China, is that actually governments can use the very same technology to, if anything, strengthen the vice-like grip that they have over the information that is kind of circulating on some level within the country. But we'll move on onto the level that I guess that the actual people who are your main concern here. In light of that kind of very strict control that Pyongyang seeks to exert over the information environment, we have this notion of information crimes, essentially, which are treated very severely and you discuss in the second chapter, Cracks in the System. So could you discuss a bit about what sorts of acts constitute information crimes and also how they're punished?
Right. And a caveat before I get into this bit, I think a lot of people are interested in this because it's, you know, it's so dramatic and it's so unfamiliar to anything that we, especially people born in consolidated democracies, have experienced. So I do want to make the following caveat that what I say is they're generalities. There are, of course, nuances and, you know, exceptions and so forth. So with that kind of out of the way, so information crimes. So, I mean, these rules are codified in their criminal code. So, and it's been translated into English and other languages from Korean. So if anybody wants to look this up and see for yourself, you're absolutely more than welcome to do so. So the very act of consuming unauthorized information from the outside through an unauthorized device is in and of itself that in and of itself could be considered a political information crime. Now, the very act, we can break that down. So the very act of having an unauthorized foreign-made device is very sensitive because there's the potential that one could access more sensitive information. That's one. Another one is if one is accessing foreign information, no matter how unpolitical and uninteresting that may be, the content may be, that is one step towards engaging with potentially imperial, quote-unquote, imperialist decadent culture, or becoming a participant of the counter-revolution. So basically, a revolution that's against the North Koreans' regime's pursuit to maintain a successful regime. So that's the overarching framework in which we could then look at much more specific examples. And so and then with that becomes there's gradations of what becomes quote unquote more criminal and less criminal. Some of the variables that we can think about are like, who is catching the individual? Who is the individual? Is that person very elite, very important, very not? What are they being caught with? Were they watching a silly Russian, maybe like a Russian, I don't know if comedic and Russian really go together, but you know, is that person watching like a Russian animation for children, which may be a little bit less sensitive of a crime? Or is that person watching like a romance, a romantic comedy or something made in France or South Korea or something like that, which would be considered much more criminal? And then depending on that, individuals we doled out various sentences. And now, like this kind of crazy story out there that, oh, if a North Korean is caught with any foreign information, they're going to be shot to death. That's not necessarily true at all. I mean, there are many instances of individuals who have become scapegoats or who have become who are the unlucky people to be publicly executed for information crimes. And the fact that we even say that and think that's part of any normal world is insane, but it's absolutely true. But it's not true for 100% of the people who are caught. There are other very, very severe punishments, like sentences to political prison camp or re-education camp or labor camps between 6 months to many years. In very bad cases, when an individual is caught circulating information, not only is one watching or consuming stuff, but they're actually making copies and then circulating, that person will definitely get in a lot of trouble. And so it really does depend on what the alleged quote-unquote crime is, and if that person is unable to bribe their way out of the situation. But
right.
Yes, go ahead.
And when you mentioned the bribe, actually just to pick up on that, the kind of bribe culture that has become a part of day-to-day life, is this still something that is very you kind of discuss it in the context of the early 2000s and when I guess more sort of information was starting to come into the country by various means. Is bribery an option for anyone who has the kind of money, or is the strictness of the state's enforcement of that often blind to even the possibility that bribes could be a way out?
So yes and no. And for listeners who want to read more about this, I think North Korea Inc., it's a work that North Korea Incorporated, work that Dr. John Park and Jim Walsh have been working on for years. This is, you know, they've written a lot on this topic. It's more on North Korean shell companies, but there's a lot of work on bribery, and I think it's fascinating. In which case, bribes are actually just incorporated as another business cost. It's not even considered really a bribe. But in this context, where it's much more individualized and political. So I think there's, from what I've gathered and listened to over the years from North Korean defectors and researchers, most people not only need to, but have to bribe their way into and out of what we would normally consider daily activities. And so whether an individual wants to set up her vendor shop in the middle of, you know, a market, but she doesn't have a permit, she may have to pay an extra bribe. Or if she wants to get a better spot in the market, even though she does have a vendor permit, she may still have to pay the people a bribe. If a local police or a monitor grabs a student randomly, which that person is more than able to do, and say, "Hey, let me see what's on your cell phone," without any probable cause, and that student is caught having listened to a Korean song or a jingle or something like that, that in and of itself Exactly. Sorry, a South Korean song. That in and of itself is a crime, but maybe that student could bribe his or her way out of that situation. But then if certain certain alleged crimes are just way too high, then it may be really difficult to use money to get out of the situation.
I see. Well, and I think you reflect on some of these specific situations. All of this, I should reiterate, is brought out in the book in tremendous richness from first-hand accounts of your interlocutors. And this particular, I think, case of bribery and so on just shows the extent to which the kind of information sphere has been changing in step with certain economic patterns in the country and a kind of marketization, which we may return to in a second. But moving forward in the book, you just sort of jump back. I mean, I was particularly taken by what you said just a moment back about the difference between situations where North Koreans may be consuming, for example, a Russian kids show. For the record, I'd actually say that humor and Russian definitely go together on many occasions. But the difference between that and say something from a more unequivocally capitalist or kind of enemy country, the way it follows some of these contours, perhaps, of politics that North Korea has long been sort of lodged in, old Cold War dynamics, maybe even. But in the third chapter of the book, you talk about some of these kind of more established ways of accessing information that North Korean citizens have had, from rumor and gossip that circulates within the country and that gets in via Chinese traders or people who travel out to China and then return, as well as things we've heard about, these kind of quite well-publicized events such as the launch of freedom balloons from South Korea over the DMZ into the north. Could you just give us a bit of a bigger picture there of the sort of pre-hyper-technologized sources of outside information that North Koreans have had access to?
Sure. So I believe in the book, I start with pretty low tech, and I guess that's in and of itself is biased, but you know, VHS tapes and how they used to be brought in way back when North Korean diplomats would come back to the country from, you know, their postings, and they would bring these things for their kids or whatever else. And that was just their very old school way of bringing information in. But kind of moving forward to the 90s, where there was a lot more flowing of information and people across the North Korean-Chinese border because of markets developing and so forth. There were just very natural influx of information because people were working with traders, traders, working with traders, and just trying to see, you know, trying to gauge prices of commodities they were trying to sell and buy. So from what I can gather, it wasn't really politically motivated. You know, what's the situation of US-DPRK relations, but it was much more like, what are the weather patterns going to be like? What price trends do you see for rice and so forth from China? But through these interactions, people are smart everywhere we go. They have common sense wherever we go. And a lot of the North Koreans through those conversations were able to infer that, wow, China is much richer than North Korea. South Korea is much richer than North Korea. Right now, in 2018, 2019, I would say the majority of North Korean citizens recognize their country is not that wealthy, especially in relation to many of the other countries that their government talks about. This is just kind of a known phenomenon now because of the level of information that's been circulating in North Korea since then. But so there's been, like you mentioned, other quote-unquote low-tech ways of foreign information trying to then intentionally be sent into North Korea. So with premeditated intent by actors from physically outside North Korea. And those actors may be North Korean defectors or South Korean natives who are working with defectors or other Western quote-unquote do-gooders or churches or whatever else who are intentionally pushing information into the country. And some of those methods include, like we say, you know, the very well-publicized airborne balloon leaflets. And and this is sending leaflets across boundaries and borders through these airborne methods. You know, this has been a tactic not only in the Korea context, but, you know, around the world for many, many years, so it's not new to the North Korean context. Sending USBs is another very highly publicized way of how external actors try to push information in. These days, there's been a couple organizations and entities trying to send over USBs and rice, raw rice, and U.S. dollars and water bottles from South Korea to North Korea. I mean, there's all sorts of very creative, low-tech, if not non-technical ways people are trying to do this. And those are some of the examples that I was with explicit permission able to describe in the book. Also, these are just stories that are well publicized in the media. A lot of the tactics that I did not include were those that are absolutely not not even low profile. They're non-existent on the public's radar because some entities and their strategies are much more sensitive this whole thing is sensitive, but they're much more covert and they don't want to attract any attention to their work so that they can just keep on quietly pushing information in through not only different low tech means but relatively high tech strategies. And this is something that perhaps we can talk about later, but the North Korean government is one that is not to be underestimated in all sorts of dimensions, but especially in this dimension of information penetration, because they are very aware that foreign information has the potential. I mean, I won't speak for them, I can't, but I think that the reason why they're so sensitive to foreign information coming in is this type of stuff has foreign content has a potential to delegitimize North Korean regime's political legitimacy that they've been so carefully able to preserve for so many decades.
Sure. Well, we can perhaps return to that in a sec. I mean, it's kind of something that you bring together really well at the end in terms of, you know, what is this doing or what's it for, or, you know, what are the perhaps the longer term implications. Something that is, I think, something that really you shed a lot of light on that draws us away from some of these higher profile acts like sending in the leaflets. The USB stick, I guess, is the real iconic item in a way. It actually so much so that it's there kind of embossed on the book's cover, in fact. But the USB stick, in a sense, gives us a bridge to the sort of digital side of things, because actually, you know, what's going over there are things that can be played on little players that are also kind of brought over, and how those things get there is such an interesting process that I think you do shed a lot of light on. As I say, one thing that we've talked about just now is how outside groups are actively sending stuff in. So the motivation is coming from people wanting to push stuff into the country. But you reveal that actually when it comes to the more digital stuff, the underground, as you call it, in the heading of chapter 4, there's a lot of demand. There's a lot of actual North Koreans interested in specific things and maybe able to place orders for them and have them dispatched. Could you give us a bit of more of a picture of the dynamics as they now operate with more digital information flowing in, and how actually it's not just outside actors shoving stuff in there and hoping that some of it sticks or lands?
So between the writing of the book, which was 2015, and now, in the past 4 years, there's been a lot of development in not only external actors trying to get information in, but also North Korean government's capabilities, digital capabilities of trying to, you know, really block this stuff from coming in. Their devices, North Korean-made devices and software, are becoming, they're loaded with essentially malware to really circumvent some of the information coming in, blocking files from actually even opening on devices. So, you know, you stick in a USB thumb drive into one's North Korea-made laptop or tablet or whatever else, and the actual documents or files just won't open, and so on and so forth. So that's something I think is really worth keeping in mind. But what happens, what continues to happen before 2015, 16, until now, is a lot of foreign actors, and by a lot, I mean, we're talking about like dozens, we're not talking about 10, you know, hundreds or thousands, continue to try to push in all sorts of material, all sorts of content through USBs, micro SD chips, other types of storage devices, through smuggling routes, through allied businessmen and women, or generally businessmen, and through all sorts of human connections that they've been able to build with Koreans, Joseonjok, which are ethnic Koreans living in China, and other people to try to just get smuggle some of this material in. Now, it's not just foreigners kind of randomly supplying information. There is a huge demand for it. I think there could be a lot better, there could be much more attention paid to what the demand is. And some people do really, you know, clever, innovative things to try to meet such very specific demands, like a certain television show or whatever else. But some of the, a lot of the demand is, from what I can tell, from what I've gathered, are the following. News about North Korea. There's plenty of news made by North Korean government for the citizens to consume. But now the citizens, especially the young folks born in, you know, late 80s and 90s and thereafter, they're quite savvy around the country, generally speaking. And they know that the government is not telling 100% truth. I guess none of our governments are, but especially when it comes to North Korea. And they want, they and, you know, generations older than them want information about the region, about their own country. That's one. Other is just more information about defectors, just generally, but also, of course, information about their own loved ones who've left. And then just entertainment and media, stuff that we all around the world want to watch and listen to when we want to tune out or you know, just enjoy ourselves, the movies and various television shows and, you know, music and so forth. And there's a lot of other content that gets pushed in, you know, health and, you know, women's health and econ 101, business 101, all sorts of other things. But information about North Korea and general entertainment is, they are consistently high in demand.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think this is another crucial dimension to the picture you paint that helps to sort of disrupt this portrayal of the country and the people who leave it, as well as defectors or dissidents, or disrupts that politicization of everything by understanding that, of course, a lot of people just want to watch the latest hit South Korean drama, and that is then, you know, there's demand for that, and then that is dispatched accordingly because there are people in the middle who can make money out of it. You outline in a separate appendix, actually at the back, but the kind of figures in this circulation of goods appear throughout the book. What could you just you describe how the kind of actual mechanism for sending something, say, from the south to the north via China works? Could you say a bit more about how that operates, and again whether that has changed significantly in the intervening time in the last couple of years?
Yes. So for decades, people have been smuggling things into North Korea. And what you're referring to, I'm talking about family members or friends trying to get goods and money into the hands of their loved ones. So that's what I'm talking about right now. There have been many individuals who have told me the types of goods they've been able to send their family through just a network of brokers from South Korea through China into North Korea. We're talking about radios. And this is, you know, these are the following anecdote is from maybe a decade ago. Radios and certain medicines, and of course cash, and a lot of and like female toiletries, like you know, soaps and things like this. But the important thing is the radio, and I mean they're all important, but the relevant part here is the radios, medicine of course, and then the cash. What's much more common, other in addition to these, you know, care packages, if you will, is sending money, sending remittances back to their family members in the north. So there continues to be networks of brokers to get hard cash into the hands of parents and other loved ones in North Korea from their senders, who are, you know, usually family members who've defected to the south. And the way this generally works is there's, you know, there's networks of brokers in like tracing from South Korea, China into North Korea. And the middlemen usually take about a 30% or more cut of the money being sent. And this is all knowledge. Most people, because it's such a tight community, this is all based on trust. If someone takes the money, then you'll never have business again, pretty much. But they take about a 30% cut. And eventually, the family member in North Korea will receive about the remaining 70% in cash, in hard cash. There are external actors trying to make this more efficient. As we can imagine, so many physical and technological constraints from trying to minimize or trying to really push out the middlemen from taking the cut. But there's some innovations that are currently in the works to try to in this remittance space for North Korea.
One can imagine. I mean, it's just a constant kind of cat and mouse game, really, when it comes to the physical, the transfer of things and the movement of people and technology and even signals being sent over the border, right? I mean, the kind of exchanges and circulations that you discuss, at least at the time of writing of the book, were often reliant on mobile phones, Chinese mobile phones being used right up on the border so that they could catch Chinese phone signals and just call freely to South Korea because North Korean mobiles don't call abroad, and people could be up there, but speaking to people in the south from being sort of perched on the edge of the river there. But I guess now, you know, there is increasing use of blocking technologies and so on, that government is kind of catching up and trying to stop use of those phones. You've already hinted a few times at the kind of the youth and their interest in these things. And this is the subject of your fifth chapter, A New Generation Rising. You called it the kind of younger people who've grown up in the entirely or largely marketized era of recent North Korean history, the Jangmadang generation, in reference to the markets that have sprung up all over the country. I wonder, could you say something a bit more about their profile and who are these young North Koreans, and how has this changed information environment altered their outlook and their perspective on the world?
Right. So with the Jangmadang generation, so Jangmadang in Korean means like market or outdoor market, street market. And this is a clever term that I cannot take credit for. I just use it because it's been pretty widely used in the media. But essentially, this term is a loose synonym for North Korean millennials. And these are individuals who were born during or after the essential economic downturn, some call it collapse, in the mid-90s of North Korea, where North Korea suffered a huge famine in the mid-90s, coincided with Kim Il-sung's death in 1994. And also that's only a couple of years after the Soviet Union's collapse, North Koreans' main lifeline to support their economy. So the economy it really did collapse. And the public distribution system was pretty defunct by then. So people had no choice but to turn to themselves and each other to survive. And so there was a huge, it's known as the Arduous March. So tons of people, an estimate of 1 to 2.5 million individuals in North Korea passed from starvation and the effects of starvation. So we don't really know the exact numbers, but a range from about 1 million to 2.5. During this era, small markets popped up everywhere across the country, even though it was technically illegal because this is capitalistic activity. Fast forward to 2019, and these tiny markets that people just sort of created out of thin air now comprise massive, massive outdoor markets across the country. There are satellite images, people who do market analysis of North Korea, among other things, using satellite imagery. And there's an estimate, depending on how you define a large market, between 500 and 800 massive markets, each comprising over a couple hundred stalls per market. So people are now living off of the markets, essentially. So these millennials are individuals who are born during or after this marketization of the country. So they're no longer taking a ration card from their mom and going to a distribution center to get food and clothing. They're asking mom for money to then go to the markets and buy whatever mom tells them to buy. And maybe, you know, to get some sweets and candies and things like that. And so so these individuals, so, you know, these kids, not kids anymore, but these young folks are learning how to compare goods, compare prices, haggle, negotiate, trying to get the best deal for what they need to buy. And through that, you know, you inevitably have access to just market chat and gossip and prices and who's doing what, who's selling what, who, which vendors did they get it from, which vendors in China are good. You know, so South Korean skincare is better than, you know, skincare from somewhere else. So you're inevitably going to be exposed to all this type of information very naturally. And so this generation is has unprecedented levels of access to foreign information, just very naturally. I'm not just talking about young people watching movies all day long, and that may be the case for some. But generally, I'm speaking about individuals who just grew up on the markets and they just know more about the world. And that really substantively changes their perception of their state, their relationship with the state. And in turn, it substantively changes how the state needs to interact with this new generation and all the younger generations that may come after them. And so, and we see that from the North Korean government side, we're seeing pretty notable changes in the way they are presenting their news, or some of their shows and movies are a bit, I mean, I don't want to go to say like as far as savvy, but it's not as, you know, hard. It's not as kind of old fashioned socialist style anymore. And they're trying to come up with catchier songs and slogans. And there's like now advertising billboards sometimes for North Korean made products. And they're loosening up on men and women's fashion and hairstyles and all these things to make their government and culture a little bit less rigid around the fringes, to try to adapt to young people's preferences, because the regime is very aware that the young people in this country, they know a lot more than they quote unquote should.
I mean, it's absolutely fascinating that I think the changes that I guess a lot of people have with paying any level of attention to North Korean affairs in recent years have seen in terms of yet new kinds of bands, new kinds of music, new kinds of television, and also products available. It's really interesting, I think, and real the real value of this book to see how that comes as a, at least in significant measure, as a response to taste and fashion and lots of these other elements of Jangwadan generation life that you talk about in the final part of the book there. But to sort of finish up, I guess we kind of come full circle, because as you mentioned at the beginning, a lot of your interest stemmed from a somewhat sort of activist perspective on North Korea and an interest in the human rights situation, rather than just sort of, you know, casually ogling from the sidelines, as I think all too many sort of North Korea, this kind of watcher community do. And so your book very helpfully includes a chapter on implications, predictions, and a call to action, as you put it, what to do about this. So in light of these kind of changes that you're saying are occurring and as a result of the sort of information revolution, where does that leave people wanting to make a difference, how should one as an interested party approach North Korea today in light of this?
Sure. I think one lesson I've been learning along the way is, yes, North Korean people are born in a very, very different system than anything else on Earth today. But I think it's really important to keep in mind that North Koreans are human beings and are motivated and want very universally human things. And I think just remembering to really not otherwise or kind of just, you know, see them as some type of a spectacle is just really important to know. It's a pretty politically incorrect way to say this, but I think that's just a really important thing to keep in mind for individuals who are interested in getting involved in some way. I think keeping in mind that foreign information consumption is really important, but it's not going to be the silver bullet to bring substantive positive changes to the country. And so keeping that in mind, like understanding that foreign information circulation is necessary, but it will not be a sufficient condition for bringing positive change to this system is important to keep in mind. Another kind of, I guess this is more of a cautionary tale than anything else, is remembering that the regime is not standing by idly and just sort of unaware of what's happening. They are very aware. And so reading up on what the government is doing is really important. A couple of readings I could recommend are the writings by Intermedia, by Nat Kretschmann and his colleagues. That's, I think, essential reading. And then for those who actually do want to check out how they could support some of these initiatives, there are a lot of organizations out there. I won't say any in this podcast, but if you just Google it, feel free to reach out to me personally. All my information is online. There are individuals who are doing really good work, innovative work, driven by not only passion, but strategy and a sustainable campaign. And so that's just one very specific way to get involved. But yeah, it's just a combination of cautionary tales and a push for individuals to learn more, to jump in.
Yeah, well, I think that's a very encouraging way of ending it. I was thinking I might ask you about what you think is going to happen in the next few X amount of time, but maybe I won't trouble you with that kind of prediction type question, because they're never fair.
We'll have to have a whole other podcast for that.
Well, sure. Well, write another book about it, and we can discuss that. But in any case, Gian, thank you so much. We've taken up a good chunk of your time today, so I'm really grateful for your appearance here on New Books in East Asian Studies.
Oh, this was fun. Thank you.
I also would just like to ask you, before we do finally wrap up, what is your kind of current work on? What projects do you have on the go at the moment?
Oh, right. Well, I'm trying to finish up my DPhil, that's for one, my doctoral dissertation. I'm looking at early stage dissenters or first movers of dissent in authoritarian countries, and Burma is my country case study. So that's something I'm very passionate about as well. In terms of projects related to the North Korea side of things, there are a couple of projects that I'm on, all in the information space. That's annoyingly vague, I recognize. But what I will say is there are a lot of innovative opportunities for people to get involved. And one thing I hear a lot of people say is, oh, I don't know that much about North Korea, or I don't really know how to get involved, but I am a very good engineer, or I am a really good artist, or digital design, software engineer, or digital designer, or a chef, or whatever. How can I contribute? My goodness, there are so many opportunities to get involved. Really do reach out to me if any of the listeners are interested. We live in a world today where we're getting rid of siloed work, and there's so many opportunities for interdisciplinary approaches and processes and outcomes. And so if you have a skill and you're interested to get involved, please do reach out to me.
Brilliant. Yeah, well, that's a great way of wrapping up. So yes, thank you once again for appearing, Gian. It was great to have you, and it's a fantastic book.
Thank you, Ed. Take care.
Thank you. And thanks all you listeners for listening, as ever, to New Books in East Asian Studies, which is a podcast on the New Books Network. We'll speak to you next time. Goodbye.